Sisi, saying the regime's brutal measures will speed up its annihilation. Thank you for joining us. Now, the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution says the final victory belongs to the Palestinians in Gaza in the U.S.-Israeli genocidal war. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei said the Israeli massacre of women and children in Gaza shows the regime is incapable of defeating the resistance. Iran's leader stressed that Israel's defeat comes in spite of all the military and financial support the regime is receiving from its Western benefactors. He made the remarks in a meeting with the head of the Islamic Jihad movement, Ziad al-Nakhale. For his part, Nakhale said, despite all the hardships, Palestinians have foiled the Israeli plots to defeat and destroy the resistance in Gaza. He added that the people of Gaza and resistance forces are determined to continue their struggle until the final victory. The Hamas resistance movement has reiterated its determination to end the Israeli onslaught, saying the regime has failed to achieve any of its declared goals in Gaza.
When the Israeli occupation wants to prolong the battle, it doesn't want to end the war for a simple reason, which is that the Israeli occupation has not achieved any of its goals which it had declared. It hasn't eliminated the resistance. The resistance is still on the ground. It hasn't retrieved the prisoners.
In an interview in Tehran, Hayya said Israel wants to prolong the onslaught. He censured Washington's complicity in the crimes committed against Palestinians, saying the U.S. will pay a heavy price for its support in the genocide in Gaza. The deputy chief of the Hamas movement said some Arab countries' support for Palestinians have not been enough. He said the movement was prepared to show flexibility in ceasefire talks for the sake of Palestinians. He added that Hamas does not insist on ruling Gaza alone. Hayya also hailed anti-Israel operations in the region, saying the regime has failed to stop such attacks. It's nearly 6 months into the Israeli genocidal onslaught on the Gaza Strip, and the regime strikes are still killing or injuring civilians across the territory. The latest Israeli airstrikes killed at least 12 Palestinians in a house in Rafah, south of the Gaza Strip. Eyewitnesses reported about 30 killed by strikes in an industrial zone east of Gaza City. 8 people were also killed after the occupation forces bombed a house in Al-Maghazi camp in central Gaza Strip. The Israeli genocide has so far killed over 32,500 civilians and left nearly 75,000 injured. 7,000 more are unaccounted for and feared to be dead under the rubble. Our correspondent Moti Abu Musabbeh joined us earlier from the central Gaza city of Deir al-Balah to give us an update on the situation in the war-ravaged territory. Let's take a listen.
Yes, actually, the Israeli occupation forces are still decimating Gaza Strip with more airstrikes and more attacks. Those airstrikes and attacks were intensified over the last couple of hours against Gaza City, whereas Ash-Shati, Ar-Rimal, and Az-Zaytun neighborhoods were subjected to heavy bombardments. Several residential buildings were destroyed over those relentless airstrikes. In the meantime, the Israeli occupation forces also renewed the attacks and airstrikes against the western parts of Gaza City, particularly the surrounding areas of the Ashifa Medical Complex. According to the spokesperson of the Gaza's civil defense crews, hundreds of the Palestinian dead bodies are still trapped under the rubble of those destroyed houses. Those crews are unable to extract them over the ceaseless and the constant Israeli attacks that are still hitting those areas. The entire central squares were reduced to rubble over those attacks. The entire residential buildings were destroyed to the ground over the ceaseless and the chronic Israeli attacks over that area. In the meantime, the Israeli occupation forces also renewed their strikes and attacks against the western parts of Khan Yunis city. These moments, as we speak right now, the Israeli artillery is shelling those areas, targeting the residential buildings there. It's the same situation as a result of the continuous Israeli attacks. We are talking about entire residential squares were rendered to rubble over those attacks that are still hitting that area. I mean, the surrounding area of the Nasser Medical Complex and the Al-Amal Hospital. According to Gaza's health ministry, that at least 4 Palestinian dead bodies were extracted as a result of those continuous airstrikes.
Now, more than 140 Christian leaders from across the world have called for a comprehensive and permanent ceasefire in Gaza and an end to foreign military support for Israel. In a letter, the group slammed the empty rhetoric of world leaders who ignored the underlying causes of the humanitarian catastrophe in Gaza. The Christian leaders said Israel's daily bombings and its shutting off of basic life-sustaining services to Gazans are the direct causes of the crisis. The letter urged world leaders not to be silent as people continue to die in Gaza. It demanded an end to the Israeli, quote, atrocities, violence, death and destruction in Gaza. The Christian leaders also called for an immediate and adequate humanitarian assistance to more than 2 million Palestinian people in the territory. Yemen's Ansarullah leader slams the Israeli atrocities in Gaza as a stain on humanity, saying the brutal attacks will certainly accelerate the decline of the regime and its ultimate annihilation. Abdul Malik al-Houthi warned the U.S. of its consequences of its unwavering support for the Israeli genocide in Gaza. He said the Yemeni forces will continue their attacks against Israeli-linked and U.S. ships in the Red Sea. Al-Houthi added that the Yemeni forces attacked 9 ships last week, bringing the total number of ships targeted to 86.
We conducted 10 military operations this week, which were conducted with 37 ballistic missiles and winged missiles and drones, and we targeted 9 vessels, and the full sum of the number of vessels that we have targeted, 86 vessels have been targeted that are linked and associated with the Israeli enemy and the UK and the US. This is a very significant number of vessels, and it has had a very significant impact as well.
Al-Houthi said the Yemeni attacks have extremely limited the movement of Israeli-linked ships in the Red Sea. The Yemeni leader said the U.S. ships are now trying to conceal their voyages, but they fail to pass through the Red Sea unnoticed. He quoted an American officer as admitting that the U.S. Navy had not been humiliated at this level since the 19th century. Al-Houthi also hailed the million-strong pro-Palestine marches in the Arab country, saying such rallies are unparalleled in the Muslim world and show the Yemeni people's readiness for jihad against Israel. Breaking news coming in, the Syrian military says that Israeli forces have attacked the central, I think around, it was Damascus, which left a number of soldiers and civilians dead and injured, and also caused material damage. We will have the full details in our next bulletin. Now, Hamas has hailed a ruling by the International Court of Justice ordering the Israeli regime to address famine in Gaza. The resistance group has called on the international community to create a mechanism to ensure the order's implementation. In a statement, Hamas said Israel must be forced to immediately execute the World Court order. He said Israel is a fascist occupation that uses starvation as a weapon against civilians. Hamas lamented that the regime has consistently disregarded all international resolutions, including the recent resolution by the UN Security Council calling for a humanitarian ceasefire in Gaza. The group said the US cover for Israel has made the terrorist regime to behave in such a way as if it is above the law and accountability. The reaction comes after the ICJ ordered Israel to allow the immediate delivery of humanitarian supplies into the besieged territory. The court said famine has now turned from a risk into a chronic crisis for the civilian population in Gaza. The court's order urged Israel to ensure unhindered provision of food, water, electricity, and medical supplies to Palestinians. Pakistan has hosted a conference on freedom of Palestine in the capital Islamabad in solidarity with the oppressed Palestinians in Gaza. The participants called on international organizations to bring about an immediate humanitarian ceasefire in the besieged territory. Nasser Kazmi has more.
In a fervent display of solidarity with the oppressed people of Gaza, A high-profile event dubbed Palestine Freedom Conference was convened in the capital, Islamabad. Political leaders, scholars, and representatives from various advocacy institutions gathered at the conference to condemn the ongoing Israeli atrocities in Gaza and to advocate for the rights of Palestinians.
The United Nations role is getting more and more important, but we see that United Nations is going on the agenda of Israel and the agenda of America. They are not doing their good efforts to stop this war. Besides stopping the war, they are provoking the war. They are supporting the war. United Nations should take important steps to stop this war.
The event was aimed at amplifying voices against the relentless Israeli attacks on unarmed civilians in Gaza. Scholars and experts also slammed global powers for their role in perpetuating the ongoing genocide and supporting the Israeli regime.
We are not expecting much from the United Nations. More than 3,000 innocent men, women, and children have been killed. But the UN has no courage to stop Israel from doing these inhuman acts in Gaza. Muslim leaders have taken no effective step for a ceasefire in the besieged territory. They should feel shame for their silence on this massacre.
The gathering denounced Israel's military aggression against Gaza and emphasized the importance of upholding the international humanitarian law. The conference underscored the urgent need for international intervention to halt what it described as the bloodshed in Gaza. It also called for practical and immediate steps to alleviate the sufferings of the war-stricken Palestinians.
Participants in the Palestine Freedom Conference pledged to continue their efforts for the people in the Gaza Strip. They vowed to mobilize the support for the implementation of the UN resolution that called for an immediate ceasefire in the territory. Nasser Kazmi, Islamabad.
Pro-Palestine protesters occupy a government building in London, calling on the UK government to stop arming Israel. The demonstration was organised by London for a Free Palestine. We have discussed the issue with our guests in our news review programme. Let's see what they have to say.
Time now for the news review of this bulletin. Activists have staged a pro-Palestine protest inside the Department of Business and Trades in London, calling on the British government to end arms sales to Israel. The protesters from London for Free Palestine staged a sit-in in the lobby of the building. They chanted slogans like Stop Arms Sales to Israel while waving Palestinian flags. London for Free Palestine has joined some lawmakers and pressure groups like Campaign Against Arms Trade to revoke arms export licenses to Israel. On Wednesday, 130 British parliamentarians issued a letter to their government demanding an immediate end to arms sales to Israel, calling the trend totally unacceptable. Advocacy groups believe the UK-licensed weapons are being used by Israel in its genocidal war in Gaza. Peter Ford is a former British ambassador to Syria and Bahrain who joins us from Manchester. And we also have Sakina Datu, journalist, author, and producer, who joins us from London. Welcome to you both. Peter Ford, I'll first start with you. We're taking a look at this protest, which obviously is shows the courage and the conviction that the protesters have for the cause that they believe in. At the same time, it comes on the heels of the parliamentarians, I believe 100 or so, who have demanded an end to the arms sales to Israel. Tell us what you think about this type of movement, and of course the fact that you have these British parliamentarians who have requested the arms sales to stop from the UK to Israel.
Well, what's happened in London today shows the depth of anger of the ordinary British people about what Israel is doing in Gaza. The group which acted in London today, I think, has not been known before. Many new groups are emerging, dedicated to stopping the genocide in Gaza and putting pressure on the British government. There is a new focus on arms embargo. Now, more or less everybody in the UK political establishment is supporting a ceasefire, but that is meaningless if Israel continues to receive arms. There's therefore this new pressure on the government and on the opposition Labour Party to demand an arms embargo. Just yesterday, over 100 members of parliament, not the party leaders, but 100 independent action by members of parliament demanding an arms embargo. So the British government is now under serious pressure.
And Sakina Datu, we know that the UK overall has been very active in terms of the protests that have taken place and the large numbers that have turned out, in addition to, for example, these protests such as the one that we have in our news coming out and doing what these people have done. How much of a difference has that made in the overall picture when it comes to the plight of Palestinians, if you think any?
Again, you know, there was a vote for a ceasefire at the United Nations. This shows the power of these pro-Palestinian lobby and the, all the protests that are happening. There's another one on this Saturday, a big one, and we are expecting huge numbers, it being the last you know, week of the month of Ramadan. And I think the pro-Palestinians activists are saying this now, the momentum is now. It doesn't stop at just, you know, voting for a ceasefire. We're going to be lobbying for the stopping of the arms sale. We want a narrative around the Israeli lobby to stop. There is a lot of movement, for example, in terms of galvanizing the Muslim vote when it comes to elections later this year. But also, I think what is really important is that there is this feeling that it is the UK's Muslim community that is leading this. It is not true. I mean, if you look at the protests, the makeup, there is more people from different faiths than those who are Muslim. So I think the momentum in London is amazing. They are making a huge difference. And London sets pace. I think if you look at the case of South Africa and the fall of the apartheid in South Africa, a lot of movement started in London. And I think this is a very hopeful time for us here in the UK, because we feel like we are starting to make a change that hopefully, you know, will grow and will really make a difference.
Thank you for that. Let me thank Peter Ford, former British ambassador to Syria and Bahrain, from Manchester. Thank you so much. And Sakina Datu, thank you, journalist, author, and producer, talking to us there from London. Thank you to you both. With that, we come to an end for this news review.
With that, we come to the end of this bulletin. Thank you for listening. Take care and bye-bye for now.
Puzzle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure.
Hello.
IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
In Britain, concerns have grown among parliamentarians and human rights groups regarding Britain's arms sales to the Israeli regime amid the ongoing genocidal war in Gaza. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us.
Thank you.
Iran's Press TV has covered this story and tells us more. A recent notable development further established the British government's complicity in the Israeli genocidal war in Gaza, as the UK High Court dismissed the case calling for an immediate halt to British arms exports to the occupied Palestinian territories, despite the massive outcry. Although British arms exports criteria prohibit licensing if there is a clear risk of a weapon being used in serious violations of international humanitarian law, the court overlooked these standards by rejecting the legal challenge mounted by the Palestinian human rights organization Al-Haq and the UK-based Global Legal Action Network in December. Shawan Jabarin, Al-Haq's general director, understandably slammed the legal verdict. Jabarin said, "The government's decision to continue supplying Israel with weapons to continue its military aggression against Palestinians of Gaza is effectively arming Israel to completely decimate the Gaza Strip, reducing Gaza's vital civilian infrastructure to rubble." In their effort to challenge the court's decision, these organizations sought a judicial review of the Rishi Sunak government's export licenses for the sale of British armaments to Israel. The legal challenge shed light on the British government's license for the sale of British arms to the Israeli regime across various categories, including components for military radars, targeting equipment, combat aircraft, and naval vessels. The Campaign Against the Arms Trade research reveals that since 2015, Britain has licensed approximately £472 million in standard arms exports to the Israeli regime, along with 58 unlimited value open licenses. Lacking transparency and permitting unlimited quantities of arms being exported to Israel. Britain's High Court's dismissal comes on the heels of the International Court of Justice's recent order for Israel to take measures to stop its genocidal war against Palestinians in Gaza. The International Court of Justice's interim ruling on South Africa's genocide case against Israel stated that Israel is plausibly committing genocide in Gaza, triggering global pressure on governments across the world to halt their arms exports to Tel Aviv. According to multiple reports, the British government has ramped up arms exports to Israel in recent months to meet the growing demand amid the genocidal war in Gaza. The British government, led by Prime Minister Rishi Sunak, is following in the footsteps of Washington, which has pledged $14.3 billion of military assistance to the Israeli regime. The website warchild.org.uk has also covered the same story and tells us more. Concerns have grown among British parliamentarians and human rights organisations regarding Britain's arms exports to Israel. Tens of thousands of innocent Palestinian civilians have been massacred since 7th of October when Israel launched its brutal war on Gaza. The civilian infrastructure also lies in complete ruins in Gaza. Some members of the British Parliament have expressed worry over the violation of international humanitarian law through their government's arms exports to the Israeli regime. The Scottish Nationalist Party, SNP, has urged the government of Prime Minister Rishi Sunak to put an immediate end to export licenses to the Israeli regime and refrain from granting new ones. Human rights groups in Britain have specifically called on the government of Rishi Sunak to halt its arms exports to Israel, citing concerns about potential war crimes against Palestinians. In December, a letter from a consortium of rights groups highlighted Britain's contribution of approximately 15% of components in the F-35 stealth bomber aircraft used in the bombing of the Gaza Strip. The letter read, "Britain provides approximately 15% of the components in the F-35 stealth bomber aircraft currently being used to bomb Gaza, including the rear fuselage, an active interceptor system, ejector seats, aircraft tires, refueling probe, laser targeting system, and a fan propulsion system, adding that the British-supplied components had been utilized by the Israeli regime in previous wars as well, notably during the 2008-2009 war in Gaza. Citing a 2014 review by former British Prime Minister David Cameron, the letter noted, "The commitment to suspend existing licenses for equipment and parts used by the Israeli military if significant hostilities resumed in Gaza." It also referenced international and UK laws, including Articles 6 and 7 of the International Arms Trade Treaty, as well as the UK strategic export licensing criteria, requiring the British government to halt arms transfers if a substantial risk of serious violations of international humanitarian law or human rights legislation exists. The letter documented unlawful attacks by the Israeli military on various civilian targets since 7th of October, including medical facilities, residential buildings, evacuation convoys, bakeries, water and electricity infrastructure, schools, and the United Nations facilities sheltering displaced Palestinians. The letter asserted the civilian population constitute war crimes, it noted with concern. The Israeli military has also used white phosphorus munitions in Gaza, a densely populated area which puts civilians at unnecessary risk. The British government's claims of not providing lethal or military equipment to Israel since the start of the war in Gaza in early October are contradicted by a January affidavit filed at the UK High Court. The Department for Business and Trade identified 28 current licenses and 28 pending applications for exporting equipment most likely to be used by the Israeli occupation forces in their offensive operations in Gaza. 8 human rights groups, including the Campaign Against the Arms Trade and War on Want, pointed to a discrepancy between the government's public stance and the court document, urging clarification on how it ensures weapons licensed for export have not reached Tel Aviv since 7th of October. The human rights groups highlighted concerns about transparency and the British government's clear disregard for mounting evidence of serious violations of human rights law. The group said in a letter sent to the government's publicly stated position on weapons licenses to Israel is difficult to reconcile with what the government had admitted in litigation.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are
a Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special, and I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Welcome back to a new episode of Muslim Ladies. Well, once again, I have the honor and the pleasure to be here as your host. This is Asma, of course. And here with me, I have the pleasure to sit with Sister Nahid, She's a researcher on women's study. And then let her talk about herself. So, assalamu alaikum, sister.
Assalamu alaikum to you and all your dear listeners. This is Nahid, and I'm so honored to be with you today.
Thank you for my coming pleasure. Here. So, previously on Muslim Lady, we started this topic of how to get into a perfect marriage and what are the most important factors of a healthy marriage. Now, we went through some points that were so much important, like a marriage starts with awareness. Both sides must have an awareness. And aside from that awareness, which comes out of a study, knowledge, maturity, and experience, like not you yourself, because we live only once and it's impossible to have too many lives, but then you can have it from the experience of other people. You can have it from the advices that come to you from other people who have been there and done that. So this was the very important part. And also we got to the fact that there must be a compatibility, like the person you pick as your match must match your own perspective, must match your own way of thinking and the goals you're setting for your future. Like you must not be two lines that would never cross. So, sister, as for today, we're going to continue with the factors.
Yeah, not mentioning compatibility anymore because I guess we have talked about it enough.
Exactly.
The next factor I'm going to mention is financial stability.
Mm-hmm.
It's like for both partners to be at one level of stability, financial stability, at which they can fulfill the responsibilities that they are supposed to face in a life that is shared between the both of them. And I really agree that the big part of this responsibility is for men. They're supposed to be the big supporter of the family. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I believe that also girls should be at one level at which they can just fulfill some of the requirements of life. Like I can even refer to the fact that they should be compatible in even the social class. That's why we say having the financial stability is very important. But I believe that although men are supposed to be the responsible person considering the financial stability, at the same time, girls are supposed to have one acceptable level at the time of marriage as well.
The thing you mentioned is very logical. That's what they do in today's world. But from an Islamic perspective, like from the verses of the Holy Book of Quran, when there is these two people who have found each other and they feel like they can match each other, like they can complete each other, then God is the one who's going to support them, be it financially, mentally, whatever. Now, I don't say that, again, hastily you jump and rush yeah. into a life you do not know anything about, but just as you mentioned, yes, you have to have at least a stable financial status, but at the same time, do not think that if you're not rich enough to get into marriage.
No, it's not about being rich. You know? It's just about having an acceptable level.
Even if you're poor, God is going to compensate for that.
Yes. God is surely supposed to. Not supposed to. Let's say God is there for
you. He has promised us.
Yeah, God has promised the support.
Yeah, he says when there is a marriage, he's going to be the one who's going to support the young people who are getting married.
It's nothing to be ignored, but still, this is part of the education that we should have. Like,
mm-hmm.
we should know that if we're going to marry, we should have at least one stable financial
yeah.
situation. Like,
yeah, exactly. That's pretty logical.
Sure. At all levels of our life, we are going to. And even right now, we are facing a lot of financial problems, but I don't mean like you should have an ideal lifestyle mm-hmm. the time you're
because
married.
That's the point I'm adding. Like in today's world, these youngsters, like boys and girls, they both think that they should not get married unless they have finished their education, unless they have a perfect account.
This will never happen.
Perfect bank account. Like they have houses, they have cars, they have everything.
But there is no time that you will be at the same time energetic to start a new life and so rich and you'll have everything prepared for you. I'm not looking for that kind of life. I'm talking about the stable situation.
Yeah. So we're not talking about perfection.
No.
We're not talking about dreamland.
No.
It's just about being logical. Like when you have too many problems, financial problems, you cannot afford a life in today's world.
Exactly.
But God has promised us that when you have this decision for marriage, with good intention, of course, not like, okay, I'm going to marry her because she's so beautiful, I'm going to marry her because she's so rich. No, with good intention, with the intention that I'm going to build a family, I'm going to improve myself. This other person is going to be as the wings for my betterment. We together are going to create a life which is going to help us both improve ourselves. With good intention, if you get into marriage and then ask Allah's help, then for sure He's going to be there and He would actually bless you with stuff you would have never thought about. That's the whole idea about marriage from an Islamic perspective, that if you just get into the intention of marriage, then God is going to afford all the expenses for you. This was just one part of what you said. The other part was about girls playing a role in the creation of this family. Like, I do agree with the fact that she must play a role, but for girls to go to work, to have a job, as the, you know, what we see in today's world, like boys are searching for girls who are working. Like they are counting on them as the money makers. This perspective is a wrong perspective.
Yeah, what I meant by the girls having a stable financial situation was that the girls should be able to sometimes fulfill their own needs, not the other partner's needs. Like sometimes the girls should not be that much dependent on the other party. And they can have their own life, but I have seen this situation in today's world.
Like, unfortunately,
boys are waiting for a rich girl to come and change their life.
Yeah.
This is not what we mean.
Which is actually disgusting.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
It's so horrible for a man to think of a woman as the moneymaker, as the breadwinner. No,
definitely.
Guys, this is your own responsibilities.
Definitely.
This girl comes out of her father's house with too much of dreams, with too much of hopes. She's going to pin her hopes on you as a man to shoulder her problems, her burdens, not to put a new burden on her shoulder. So this was just another part to just capture your attention, to just focus upon, to just have it in your mind. But then let's get into a break, and then we'd be back with more factors. Welcome back. Yes, you're listening to Muslim Ladies. So all the girls who are wishing to have a perfect marriage, we are going to count just some of the factors that might help you for your best decision. Like we went through awareness, you must have maturity. And then also we talked about compatibility. And then we came to the financial point, which was so prone to discussion, like there's a lot of detail into it. We have been through some part of it, but then let's get into the other factors.
The next factor I'm gonna mention is the religious commitment. You know, in a lot of Islamic texts it is mentioned that when you're choosing your partner, choose them among the religious people, because if a person believes in God and is obeying the Creator, surely that person will understand that God's orders in the relation to the partner. Like, God has too many orders for us, too many guidance for us. And if we are religious enough, we will surely follow the same order of God. And this will lead to a good life. Like we have one narration from Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wa sallam, who has said, a woman is married for four reasons: her wealth, her family status, her beauty, and her religion. Choose the one who is religious, may your hands be rubbed with dust, which means you may prosper in your life. Mm-hmm. If you choose the woman who is not just marrying for beauty, for wealth, for these kinds of stuff. And it's the same for boys as well. Like we mentioned, there are too many boys who are just looking for money, looking for a
beauty,
good life.
For beauty.
Exactly, beauty and the ideal life.
Yeah.
But if you can find that boy who is just following Allah and is following the orders of God, you will be sure that that person is not looking for money. That person is just following the same order from God himself, who has asked people to marry to complete each other's lives, to make a virtuous life.
Yeah, like religion, actually, when we say religious people, we mean people who care for borderlines.
Exactly.
Like religion is going to give you a list of borderlines. So the one who cares and who is considerate about these borderlines for sure is a person who is worthy of trust.
Yes.
Because they would consider the other person's needs, rights, and stuff like that, and they would never cross the borderline.
And all these stuff are just clearly stated in the Quran and in the religious texts.
Exactly.
So if a person is religious enough, that person has mastered these orders and these facts about life.
Of course. And it, of course, there must be, again, a compatibility in religious stuff as well.
Yes.
Like if you have religious commitment and you're searching for someone who does not have the same perspective, who does not have the same set of rules, then you're going to suffer a lot because, again, it's going to be like two different separate roads that would never meet. So take this into consideration as well.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
Going through the next factor, I can mention the emotional maturity. You know, handling the ups and downs of a life that is shared with another person calls for all the attention of a person and the knowledge of a person to be emotionally mature.
Yeah.
Like the thing that is, again, sadly observed in the societies, like boys and girls are not emotionally mature enough.
Exactly,
some of them,
yeah.
They're just marrying for their own personal reasons, like that girl is so beautiful, I like to share my life with her.
And with a lot of delusions and illusions.
Yeah, exactly. And like, that is so sad.
Like, unfortunately, that's so sad. Like, they have this mirage in their head, and then so hastily they get to meet that mirage. But once they meet it, they understand that it was nothing of the kind they have created in their own mind.
Yeah,
like all of them are creating and building these castles in the air. And once they get to see the reality is not just compatible to what they have had in their brain, then they would turn into these depressed, delusional people.
Yeah, which surely leads to divorce or too many problems in their own life.
Yeah, one of them has to suffer more than the other.
Exactly. Or that life is supposed to just end.
Unfortunately,
and I
with a child even.
Yeah, yeah. That
and
even
then
makes
when,
the situation worse.
Yeah, it would get into an even worse situation when there is a child engaged in the middle, which is so sad, and we see a lot of that these days.
Yeah, we're sadly monitoring a lot of these kinds of problems in today's world, and I label this to nothing but the partners not being emotionally mature.
Unfortunately,
we are supposed to be educated. We're supposed to know about the other partner. I mean, the other partner's ideas, world,
needs
life.
Needs and rights.
Exactly. And unless we gain enough information, we cannot have a successful life with them.
That's very true. Yeah, check to that. It's very important. Thank you, sister.
My pleasure.
And thank you to our listeners for staying with us. Yes, this was just some factors, but not all. Yet in the coming episodes, we're going to cover more factors. So thank you for staying with us. Until another episode, I just bid you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
I know I'm waiting, waiting for something, something to happen to me. But this waiting comes with trials and challenges. Nothing in life is free.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/parstodayen. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/parstodayenglish.
Ayahs, 30 days. A monotheist person not only reflects on the Noble Quran, but also tries to explain the ayahs of this heavenly scripture to others and make them familiar with its teachings. Explicating of the Quranic teachings, first of all, was the duty of the Prophet and his infallible successors, peace be upon them. Every faithful person, too, according to the extent that they had learnt from the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them, embarked on this heavy duty. So the ulama or Muslim scholars took over this duty after the occultation of the 12th infallible successor of the Prophet, Imam Mahdi, may God hasten his reappearance, and have seriously continued this job until present day. Today this duty has become even more important because of a broad assault of the enemies against the beliefs of Islam and humanity. Today, in the 17th episode of this series, we're going to dwell upon ayahs 39 and 40 of Surah Hajj of the Holy Quran and explain its message of struggling against oppression. Please stay with us. It is very important in Islam to know wrongdoing and oppression. It has even been understood by oppressors and wrongdoers themselves. That's why they try to show their wrongdoing as trivial in the eyes of the people. This is what we can see in cyberspace today. In other words, oppressors and violators of human rights try to exonerate themselves of any wrongdoing and try to justify their heinous crimes that they have committed. Nowadays, the crimes taking place in Gaza are called self-defense by the media. Whereas, It's an extra oppression enforced on a nation which has suffered from occupation, massacre, and all sorts of crimes and tortures over the past 75 years. The Palestinian people have been denied their basic rights, their right to determine their own fate, and other fundamental rights, while the image of the occupying regime is being beautified and shown as oppressed and innocent more than ever. After 75 years that the oppressed people of Palestine have decided to take on the brutal Israeli regime with their armed struggle, this is being portrayed as a wrongdoing by the Zionist regime. Allah, in Ayahs 39 and 40 of Surah Hajj in the Holy Quran, says, "Those who are fought against are permitted to fight because they have been wronged, and Allah is indeed able to help them. Those who were expelled from their homes unjustly only because they said, 'Allah is our Lord.' Had not Allah repulsed the people from one another, ruin would have befallen the monasteries, churches, synagogues, and mosques in which Allah's name is mentioned greatly. And Allah will surely help those who help him. Indeed, Allah is strong and invincible. For sure, Allah has allowed the oppressed in the world to help them, and he has promised to help them." Now you may well ask, why doesn't God himself uproot oppression? The answer has been given in Ayah 4 of Surah Muhammad in the Holy Quran. That is Allah's ordinance, and had Allah wished, he could have taken vengeance on them, but he may test some of you by means of others. No doubt, the growth and perfection of human beings will occur in tests and hardships. When a seed wants to grow to turn into a robust tree, it should be put in the soil and tolerate the pressure of the soil. Then it goes deep into the soil to come up and grows to become a sapling and then a tree. The Almighty has ordained oppressors a means for testing the faithful and helping them grow. This will distinguish a faithful person from an unfaithful person. The world is the scene of combat and conflict between faith and disbelief, justice and injustice. This will cause flourishing of capacities and potentials. Another question which may cross your mind is, how do oppressors become powerful? The answer is clear. An oppressor becomes powerful when some people accept his wrongdoing and are indifferent towards his wrongdoing. An emphatically recommended principle in Islam is that we should neither wrong nor be wronged. Ayah 279 of Surah Baqarah in the Holy Quran tells the faithful that they neither wrong anyone nor are they wronged by others. According to the hadith, there are many oppressed in hell who are suffering the punishment of hell because they were able to repulse oppression, but they didn't, and this made the oppressor intrepid and more oppressive. Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, 3 days before Ashura, quoting from his grandfather, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, said, "Anyone who sees an oppressive ruler turning God's haram or forbidden act into halal or permitted act, breaching Allah's covenant, opposing the practice of Allah's messenger, wronging among the servants of Allah, but then he does not oppose him verbally or practically, it behooves Allah to cast him in the place of that oppressive ruler."
Thank you.
We should not forget that being pleased with the deed of an oppressive person is equal to oppression. Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him, says, anyone who is pleased with the deed of a people is like the one who has accompanied them, and he who turns towards a falsehood has in fact committed two sins, the sin of doing the false deed and the sin of being pleased with it. As a matter of fact, being pleased with falsehood is not a petty sin and will incur God's punishment. For instance, the people of Thamud, the people of Prophet Saleh, didn't oppose the divine order about the camel, which was the miracle of Prophet Saleh, peace be upon him. Only one man cut off the camel's legs and killed it, but God punished them all. Why? Because they were pleased with the action. Now the Zionist regime is massacring Palestinians in the Gaza Strip with full support of the United States and various European countries, while most of the Arab governments are just spectators to the crimes being committed by the Israeli regime. The so-called international organizations are also tacitly looking on as the genocide wreaked by the Israelis is unfolding in Gaza. For sure, these organizations and governments are complicit in the Israeli regime's crimes and atrocities in Gaza. All these governments and organizations are able to at least express their opposition in public, but not a single word is heard from them. Yet, we believe that the oppressed people of Palestine and all the oppressed peoples of the world will take revenge. Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him, says, the day of the oppressed against the oppressor is harsher than the day of the oppressor against the oppressed.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iran's leader says the massacre of women and children in Gaza proves Israel is incapable of defeating the resistance despite the West's all-out support. More than 140 Christian leaders call for a permanent ceasefire in Gaza, urging the U.S. and its allies to stop supplying arms to Israel. And the leader of Yemen's Ansarullah movement describes Israel's crimes in Gaza as a stain on humanity, saying the regime's brutal measures will speed up